wants.
Okay.
Okay, I've completely forgotten where we were.
Well, one thing I wanted to get down, just your own background in science and biology.
Oh. Okay, I have a degree in biology, and I have a BS, and I have a BS in wildlife management.
And where did you go to school?
I went to school at Northern Michigan University in Michigan, and then I finished at University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Was that with the wildlife?
Yeah.
Oh, you got both degrees?
I got both degrees. I finished both degrees at the University of Alaska.
And I am 6 credits away from a BA in science.
In biology.
Master's in biology and a minor in history and journalism. Mm-hmm. And I have 2 more sociology classes to take.
Okay. Not trying to correct you, but you meant to say a bachelor's in biology.
Bachelor's of Arts.
A BA in biology, not a BS. There's a difference, right?
You had said master's.
I did say master's.
I can prove it with this tape.
That's a good one.
Somebody's got delusions of grandeur.
That's pretty good. So when did you do that?
I'm so glad you caught that.
Okay. I didn't know master's degrees had to take sociology.
Well, I wanted people hearing, you know, your critique of the science to know that you guys have degrees in science, in biology in particular, and Charlie has the ABD, all but degree. Six more credits. I haven't bothered you about that in the last 30 years.
That's right.
Somebody
still
should.
Time.
I used to. And we were on fish size, and maybe we kind of went through that.
Well, it's just, I mean, fish used to be huge. I mean, they used to be 8-year, you know, they wouldn't return till 8 years. They were called 8-year-old fish. They would be, you know, 70, 80, 90-pound fish. They're gone. They're extinct. There's no more of them. There's the 50, 60-pounders, the 7-year-old fish. They think there's less than 1% of them left. So now we're down to the 5- and 6-year-old fish, the 30 and 40-pounders. These big mesh nets just catch the big fish. And so that's all they use down the lower river.
Still?
Year was the first year I said you have to go to... Was a 7-inch mesh now? 7 1/4 something?
I think it's 7 1/4 is the maximum size now. And that was finally the first nod to this notion that maybe the fish size...
We did this proposal from this part of the river to make have it go down to 6-inch mesh to let what was left of the big fish get through to spawn, you know, most of them.
In the
upper middle river, you know, that went over like a lead balloon, and so Fish and Game, the Board of Fish did this 7 1/4-inch mesh, which now is just targeting the 5- and 6-year-old fish, you know, the next biggest fish that are left down. Now it's just targeting them. You better check on that.
Okay.
I'm not sure. It's 7 1/2, 7 1/4, 7. You know, it's less, you know. But now it's just targeting the 30 and 40-pound fish. I mean, that's what that size mesh will do. So basically, they've just skewed it down a little bit. But there is no more 50 and 60-pound fish anyway, basically. There's a few out there, but very few. So now they're hitting those the hardest.
No.
You know, which is completely, you know, they should have just, they probably would have been better off to keep it at 8 1/4 because some of those would have gotten through, you know. It just seems like now they're just targeting the next size down, you know. Now we're going to be down to 20-pound fish.
Well, to clarify this, too, there is, you know, a certain amount of sort of sexual dimorphism with king salmon. You know, the jacks, which is at this point kind of like the 10 to 18-pound range,
males.
Are almost exclusively males. Then from about 20 some on up are the females. So by selecting for the big fish, which these large mesh nets did on the Leucon, they're essentially selecting for the females. And that's the other really alarming thing about Stanley's figures, is that the male to female ratio is way, way out of whack.
It's way more males
than females. You know, the number of females is declining steadily along with the size decline.
I mean, a lot. I mean, it's like not even a quarter of them are females anymore.
Not even a quarter of which?
Of the king salmon. He's got this chart.
Of this random grab sample.
Of the wheels, you know. Not even a quarter of them are females. Which is where you get your next fish. And the bigger the fish, the way more eggs they have.
That's classic fish science for cod, you know,
yeah,
salmon.
I mean, it's just the way
species.
It is.
You know, the big females are the big producers.
And
those
so,
are the ones you really want to put on the spawning ground.
And those are the ones that aren't getting there. And so it's no wonder that the fish sizes go. I mean, that they've been targeting these big fish for so long, and just the big fish with the nets. That, I mean, I'll be amazed if this run survives. I really will.
Okay, now
next
I've got
20
a couple
years.
More clarifying questions. First of all, like you were saying that the 70, 80, 90 pound fish have been out in the ocean for 8 years.
They're gone. They're extinct.
So what I'm getting at is some of what this is to do with is that they're spending less time in the ocean, and might that be owing to some other reason?
It's like there's a specific group, you know, like these fish would stay out that long. And, you know, every year they stay out there, they get bigger. They're not in the ocean 8 years. They spend like a year here in the river, and then they go down. So they're out there 7 years or whatever. But they would come back on their eighth year. That's how old they would be. But they don't, those fish aren't there anymore.
So you're saying like it's like a subspecies?
Yeah, that's what it was like.
A couple of qualifications. One is that this is referring to the Yukon.
Yes.
Salmon run.
Just
we don't. I don't know what they're doing down on the Kenai.
Yeah, this is just Yukon.
Alaska.
I don't know anything about the other runs.
And I don't know if anybody knows why Stanley might have a line on this or 80.
Well, Virgil was saying.
Why do they have all these different age classes? What is it? There's some biological advantage conveyed by being an 8-year-old fish waiting that long to return versus being a 4-year-old fish.
Okay,
and
well, the way Virgil put it was
yeah.
that those fish are extinct, and that the seven-year fish, he said this, you know, 8 years ago, there was like 1% of them left.
Well, what Dan was asking, was there a chance that
just all the fish
out in the ocean are such
no,
that...
No, I think there was specific fish that stayed out there longer. I mean, that's how Virgil put it.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Okay.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to talk to a real fisheries biologist and what would be the advantage conveyed in spreading out the return time between, say, 4 and 8 years.
But some of these fish that are coming back that are this big, they're not staying out there 4 years. They're coming right back.
Well, I'm talking just about females. Jacks are coming...
3 years.
We'll take it.
Basically, what I'm trying to get at is that there's, you get into an area of fish biology rather than fish management that deals with questions of why do, for example, the jacks, who are really, you know, these are like 10-pound fish, what would be their advantage in coming back early? And there's some thought that maybe the big males who are monopolizing the reds and fighting off these little guys, maybe they're going to have a careless moment, and one of these little guys can dart in and drop his load on the eggs, and so that confers a possible advantage in coming up early. just as, you know, among humans, you know, there's tall people and there's short people because, you know, you never know what might come in handy, and so it's good to have a sort of an array. And then the whole thing about the females is what's the purpose of waiting until 8 years?
Because you could produce a lot more.
Well, but then why don't they all stay out?
I don't know.
But that's what I'm trying to get at, is that this is a biology question
that may or may not
have answers to it.
But the way Virgil put it was that it was like, I mean, he didn't call them subspecies, but that's what they were acting like. There were no more of those fish staying out eight years. Those were gone. They'd fished them out.
Right. No, I completely accept that. That cohort is not there anymore for whatever reason. But, you know, even though it might not be the case, I suppose there's a possibility that ocean conditions are working against fish who stay out that long. Who knows? But, I mean, the more obvious explanation to me is the fact that they've been fished out.
Well, you have this run that's been going on forever, and then all of a sudden it starts getting in trouble. Well, they didn't used to target it this heavy, you know, back in the day, you know, people got what they could get for the winter, you know. Mm-hmm. And now you have this huge fishery shut up downriver and up here, you know, to a certain extent up here. You know, and all those fish are getting shipped out to other places. You know, they're not staying, you know. So it's like, I mean, they've overfished it. I mean, it's typical of any other run that has gone, you know.
Seems pretty likely that's the case.
You know, all the other runs that have been fished out. I mean, look at what the Columbia used to produce, you know. Mm-hmm.
But I guess the thing that maybe would be worth bearing in mind is the salmon wild card. Like with the chum salmon, everybody thought, the chum salmon are on the skids, it's going to be a long time before they build up. All of a sudden there's a million damn fish, or whatever it was that year, that showed up. Why?
Yeah, but they were up and down before that. We had good runs before that.
Well, better runs certainly than the low runs of the mid-90s. But I guess the thing is one thing that was in that small fish thing, they did, since this was Yerdfa's information deal, they also had these experts there in ocean currents in the Gulf of Alaska and the Bering Sea and you know, like deep ocean fisheries guys. And they kind of, their take on it was like, we don't know. There's a lot happening out there and we don't know what it is. And things are changing. You know, the Pacific Decadal Oscillation is in play. You know, that's that 10-year cycle of abundance and scarcity with salmon that has to do with water temperature. Then there's weird El Ninos, and then there's, you know, these strange diversions of current that resulted in the blooms of the coccolithophores with the like aquamarine colored water of the tropics way up in the near the Bering Sea, and catching tuna in southeast Alaska, all that stuff. So I mean, I guess have to at least tip our hat slightly to the idea that something might be going on that we don't understand in the deep ocean.
Well, they never used to have that problem.
Yeah, of course they didn't used to have global warming too, or pollock fishery. So.
Well, you're given a certain amount of fish coming up the river. If you want to see it continue, you better do something to see that.
Yeah.
You do what you can to make it keep going.
Exactly. And it's all too...
And I don't see people downriver grappling with that whatsoever. In fact, I've had managers tell me they don't... A lot of people down there don't even understand that these fish have to go up and spawn so that there'll be more fish. They don't even get that connection.
Really?
Yes.
I didn't know that. Huh?
Yes. I've had it stated to me. From managers up at Stanley's Fish Camp say that to me. They don't even understand that these fish have to go up and spawn so that they will get more.
It's like the ultimate cape fishery.
I mean, they just don't, there's no connection between what they're getting at the mouth and what's happening up in Canada. There's no connection. to them. They don't understand it.
Mm-hmm. So I'm a little confused. Like, how can you guys be showing the average size fish can be 10 pounds and the lower river guys be saying, we're not noticing any change?
They don't catch little fish. They only catch big fish. They are catching almost all the big fish. And when we, not this summer, but the summer before, no, it was two summers. It was in 2008. They actually shut them down early for they shut them down early for commercial fishing. They still had commercial fishing that year, but not as much. And what they did was they restricted them to 6-inch mesh after a certain point in their run. It was late in their run, you know, it was still in the middle of our run. To the day, you know, like I said, Stanley can track how fast these fish are going and know when they're going to get hit the rapids. To the day that they put them on that 6-inch mesh, this was in 2008, our fish size dramatically increased in the wheel. I mean, to the day. And then last year, we noticed it big time. They had no commercial whatsoever in 2009. Our average fish size went from 11 point something pounds to 14 point something pounds. It was dramatic change. Now this year, the run was a lot worse.
And they didn't do the windows strictly.
They didn't
as
do.
They did last.
No,
year.
They didn't do. You know, everybody wasn't on the same windows for the same amount of time, and our fish size went way down. Average size.
It might be obvious to you, but not everybody might not understand how, you know, a gill net works. I mean, it hangs there like a curtain in the water, and the fish swims along and pokes his nose into it, probably feels a little sort of resistance around its face and figures it's something that they can just bowl their way through, so they keep pushing, and then the gill net gets caught behind the gills, and then they're caught, and they can't remove themselves. If the mesh is smaller, they might get their nose partway in, but it won't get as far back as their gills, and so they won't get caught that way unless maybe they snag on their teeth, which is less likely. So big mesh catches big fish, small mesh catches small fish, and at the mouth they're still catching big fish because there are still big fish, not meaning like the 60-pounders, but the 40-pounders, they're still catching them because they're still present, but the numbers are declining.
And that's
they're selectively catching
but still,
them.
Still, they're not seeing 80, 70, 60.
No.
They must have noticed that.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know.
They're not.
Well, I don't know if they are noticing it because I don't feel like they've been forthcoming with us about it.
But you do know they haven't been catching them.
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
Well, no, I'm not sure about
they're
that.
They're not catching, nobody's catching 70-pound fish anymore.
Well, nobody in our district, but I don't know if anybody down there does. You'd have to ask.
It'd be worth asking.
That'd be worth finding. I mean, you're going on what Virgil says about the interior, which is entirely true. But what are they getting down there? Do they still get those big ones? I don't know.
He's talking about stuff down there, too.
Yeah, I don't know.
There seems like it would be data.
It would, yeah.
And the numbers that they catch is definitely lower than what they used to catch.
That's for sure.
I mean, and they can't. Yeah. I mean, they don't talk about it, but it's for sure.
Is
you
there
know?
Sampling of their size by somebody down there?
Well, the commercial catch would.
Let's
I don't
see.
Know
do
if
they
have
these
it on
variable?
Record.
That'd be a good question for Stan. Do they have variable mesh nets? I mean, that's the classic way to sample size, is they have a net that, you know, with the mesh that gradually increases. I don't know if they put it on the outshore end or the inshore end or how they. How they account for that. But
you guys are weighing your fish. Are they not weighing their fish?
No. This is a special project that Stanley's doing.
Well, I guess they could take number of fish caught by weight.
Yeah.
They probably have all that.
They do. They have the numbers and they have the weight. So that information should be available from the commercial catch ADF&G.
Okay.
Should be.
Well, that would be something to track over time.
Yeah. However, if the numbers were declining and the average size was staying the same, that would indicate something too. But yeah, I'm not sure about that. If they're still catching 80 pounders or not, I mean, Virgil seemed pretty convinced that they weren't, but I don't know where he's getting his information
well,
from.
Well, he's on the...
It's a key point,
he's
though.
He's on the board.
It's a pretty key point. That's right, yeah.
He ought to know.
What about what a smaller and smaller fish size says about the health of the stock?
It's considered to be a sign of ill health in a fish stock. I mean, that's almost universally sharks, everything, you know.
So classic sign of a kind of a wholesale degradation of the...
Is smaller size.
Well, the other thing, the other thing I was talking about with the, you know, like the people downriver, you know, not connecting with the spawning grounds. There doesn't seem to be anything on their part that we need to conserve these fish. In fact, Stanley's of the opinion that they think the king runs shot. They're going to start targeting the fall chums now. That's his opinion. That they think that they're already thinking beyond, okay, kings aren't going to be, we're not going to be able to make money on the kings anymore. Let's start a fishery on the fall chum, which they're trying to do right now.
Which the Chinese, there's now a market for that
right.
too, because fish are increasingly
so they're talking about
worldwide.
They're talking about building fish wheels down there to catch these fall chum. So they're already looking past the kings. I mean, that's what Stanley thinks. What's going on. That they already think that the king runs gone. Forget it. You know, we're not going to be making money off this anymore. So, you know, maybe a little bit, but nothing like we used to. So let's target these fish instead.
So without ever acknowledging that the run was in trouble?
Yes. Yes, I think that's what they're doing. I don't think they've ever wanted to acknowledge it. I don't think a lot of, you know, not a lot of people, but some people around here ever wanted to acknowledge it either. I don't think Fish and Game knows how to count fish. I got lots of fish this year.
Yeah, I'm actually bracing a little bit for if this gets published and ends up being a big thing. I'm bracing for the...
Well, by that
time...
You
said there were no fish here. Thanks a lot for your help, you know, but I don't care. I mean, it's like...
You mean this project I'm working on?
Yeah, if it ever did, you know, get to be a big thing, and this got the Sierra Club in here to, you know... Lobby to shut down the fishery or something like that. I mean, I could see...
There would be people here who would get you in the neck for it.
Yeah, well, I don't know if they'd get you in the neck, but
they wouldn't
like,
be happy.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of goes along with something that I think is one of the really ucky, unattractive aspects of this whole thing, which is how much is just sort of tied up in human greed. And I include ourselves in this, too. There seems to be an ability to sort of rationalize things, especially that my use is the highest and best use of the fish. And I think the Cape fishermen do that because, well, we've got the best quality fish, we've got the big boats, this is the most efficient way to catch the fish, therefore we should be the ones who are fishing them. The people who are the subsistence people, say in the lower river, say, our ancestors have been here for generations. They always, my
too.
Grandfather said that we should take care of the fish and we shouldn't fight over fish.
Yeah, we shouldn't fight
and
over
so
and say take care of the fish.
Shut up and let us fish.
Yeah. yeah.
You
don't
we're
need the
saying,
fish. You don't need the
we're
fish.
We're saying we're small time. There's very few of us. It's local. And so really we have the moral high ground. And you know, the whole thing is just should be shifted away from that whole sort of paradigm into something that's like, what do we need to do to, you know, keep these fish around? But
well,
see, the thing is, what's difficult about it is it's all tied up with a cultural identity, and that makes it really, really difficult. You could say, okay, guys, we're going to shut down the fishery for, essentially shut it down. Everybody could have maybe a fish per household or something for 5 years until we build the fish run back up. Well, 5 years is a long time. That's in that time period, what's already a sort of a waning way of life, or put differently, a way of life that's very effortful. people will just go, well, this is just not worth it. And so pretty soon they won't be there to do it. And, you know, this is a big fear because not only are they losing something that is really a part of their cultural identity, and lower river guys are as much that way as upper river guys. I mean, this is, their lives are built around these fish. Not only do they lose that, but probably the way things go in this world, especially if you're a minority, you give something up. There's a million hungry people waiting to snap it up from you if it comes back. That's always the worry about being cut back, as you set a precedent, and then when the numbers return, well, rather than return it to what it was, we've decided we're going to dole it out to urban fishermen who want to come down and do it for sport or something like that. So there you've lost your food, you've lost your cultural identity, you've lost it all, basically. So that's something that sort of militates against conservation. That's fucked up. That's the way it is.
Now, one thing I was thinking when you were talking about how the Cape fishermen or the guys who have the first crack at the fish, and the fish are in best shape then, and they're worth the most money then, and they can fish it most efficiently, and the argument for that being the best way to manage is to allow that to happen. Where in all this does the cultural and social value of the fish plug into the equation? So that even, for instance, in a place like the Middle River, where the fish are not such high quality, there still is built around this a kind of culture that mm-hmm. is seasonal, that brings young people into subsistence life ways, that right. who knows, someday may become important again.
Well,
I mean, more important.
To their credit, the managers, and this would be ADFNG with the considerable spur of having another management agency kind of horn in and take half the action, and that
fish,
is the feds. Fish and Wildlife, which and the feds have made a career basically of managing subsistence, when it looked like, because of that Zastro court case, that subsistence was going to be as a concept was going to be discarded. And you know enough about how subsistence is supposed to work, that it is a big nod, more than a nod. It's an effort to that indigenous people can continue what they're doing, unique in the world, and really to Alaska's credit that they got that far. The feds have largely held that, kind of held the line on that. So I think that's a pretty neat thing that's happened. However, the feds get their heavy hands into it, and they're uncomfortable with ambiguity, and so something like customary trade is going to be controversial, especially in times of shortage. And customary trade is people taking smoked salmon and either trading it or selling it within the village or to extended family people outside of the village. But there's no definition yet of what customary trade is. It's the legal definition is not to constitute for limited amounts of cash, not to constitute a significant commercial enterprise. What's that? Who could say what's significant?
Okay. Well, the other thing is, when they set up, all these things were grandfathered, then when they started the limited entry permits, downriver got way more commercial than they did upriver. Our quid pro quo was the customary trade.
Tacitly.
Tacitly. Right. That was, you guys aren't going to get as much commercial, but you do a lot more subsistence. But they did tons of subsistence downriver. They did tons of customary trade. They were really well organized. They had, labels printed out. Everything was, vacuum packed by their processors down there, I guess. And this was the customary. This was the subsistence caught fish, not the commercial caught fish. So they got in on that too, and they're still doing it. They're just not getting their great deal of. I mean, they got $6 a pound for their fish. We get $1 a pound. And it's not because our fish are so much less, but we don't have a market, you know. Virgil has to drive up from Fairbanks to the Hall Road Bridge, boat all the way down, boat 100 miles down, pick up the fish, go all the way back, you know, put the fish in his truck, you know.
Say how far the road.
It, you know, it's 150 miles by road and then 100 miles by boat, one way, each way. So we don't, right, we don't have a market down there. They ship them out on jets. I mean, they've got big volume.
And they have barges.
And they have barges that they process them on. I mean, and then everything can get shipped out by jet. It can be in Anchorage that day, already processed, ready to go. We don't have that here. So it's very limited how much we can sell anyway.
Subsistence, on the other hand, as practiced by people in the interior, is a really good fit, actually, because you know, most of it's mom-and-pop operations. They'll sit there on the bank and cut fish, get them in the smokehouse.
Heavy labor, though.
Yeah, it's very labor-intensive, and so that's one reason why not a lot of young people are wanting to get into it. But, you know, you can sit there and cut fish and smoke them and put them up, and they're essentially preserved. You don't have to...
Well, you got to get them to a freezer.
Well, you got to get them to your freezer at some point, but you don't have to get it there in any kind of a hurry. And so... with the weather conditions, everything in the interior, it's a good fit, and people always did that, and without really kind of thinking about it too much, everybody sort of just assumed that this is what they were sort of getting in return. That and the ability to cut chum salmon for dog food.
In return of not getting much commercial.
Yeah.
I mean, like we'd get, you know, two to three openings at the most, you know, 12-hour openings. I mean, they get tons of openings downriver. I mean, they did.
They did. They don't anymore.
Well, that's when they started. When they stopped getting those, or it started getting more limited, that's when they started targeting us and saying, oh, well, I could do subsistence. I could sell subsistence caught fish, too. But that wouldn't be good for the run, they'll say. And it's bullshit because they've been doing it all along.
Well, relations between the upper river and lower river are at a low on account of the upper river putting these proposals to the Board of Fish to limit mesh size, and you know the lower river has come back with a series of eye pokes of their own
to ban
proposals
fish wheels.
To ban fish wheels and stuff like that. So it's basically the unseemly spectacle of people squabbling over the last little fish.
It just seems
and
to me that
fishing game shows no leadership.
But it seems to me the further up the river you get, the more people realize that the fish have to be conserved. I mean, you got people up in the Yukon Territory that voluntarily do not fish to save what few fish come through so that they can spawn. To, you know, the other extreme downriver where we should be able to catch as much fish as we want.
Yeah, I wouldn't downplay this.
I mean,
it's
really
the importance of the fish to the culture too. I mean, people look at it on the surface and say, well, maybe if they went out in canoes, you know, with dip nets, that would be subsistence, but I don't think that's the case. I mean, there was a good article in Scientific American about is called The End, and there was
the end
of a lot of different things, and one was the end of cultures, and they were making the argument that because a culture adopts certain new features doesn't necessarily mean that they've abandoned
their
culture.
I'm not saying that.
No, I know you aren't. I'm not trying to put this as a dispute. I'm just trying to say that this thing of catching fish, hunting, and trapping, although it's not done with the same methods it used to, it is still, it's the thing that makes Athabascan people Athabascan,
right.
And what makes Yupik people Yupik.
Okay,
it's
I still think that with these fish anyway, it's become the money that's more important than anything else.
It creeps in.
I think it's more than creeped in. I think it's taken over down there.
Well,
to completely.
It's an interesting question. When O'Neill and I've
I mean, when they were getting lots of commercials, and then they would have them subsistence. We knew people that were working down in canneries down in Kodiak. Subsistence caught fish, and this went on for a long time. We're getting shipped out on jets.
In Kodiak, did you say?
Ended up in Kodiak. That's where Brendan Flores was working.
Oh.
And those jets were coming in with Yukon Kings, subsistence caught Yukon Kings, and getting commercially. I mean, and this last time we had the managers up here this last summer, you know, I brought that up, and the guy just kind of, you know, bypassed. Oh yeah, well, when that was going on, but we put a stop to it. Like, you knew it was going on for years, and you didn't put a stop to it, you know. And he wouldn't engage me. He wouldn't acknowledge it. He wouldn't. That was the subject closed. That went on a lot. That's money driven. That's not culturally driven.
Mm-hmm.
Same with the egg fishery here, the illegal egg fishery here. That was not culturally driven. That was money driven.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and neither one had a place.
They could be hard to separate sometimes. Those are two pretty clear
examples.
Explain
what you mean there.
By what? Culturally, economic driven?
The eggs.
You know, he talked about earlier in the 80s when we had an egg fishery going, and then there was a legal component to it, and then there was an illegal component. People were selling, people were stripping the eggs out of fish left and right, and there was all these planes coming in here taking them away, and it wasn't.
They were using the carcasses. That was by and large legitimate.
I mean, that's why, Charlie, it was so easy to have a dog team. There was fish everywhere you looked.
If you were willing to stand there and cut the fish.
Cut the fish, you know, that people took the eggs out of. But, you know,
there was not like wholesale dumping or anything like that.
No, there wasn't any dumping, but they were harvesting way more fish than they normally would, you know, to sell these eggs under the table. And people were making a lot of money at it. And then they finally got caught, and it got put an end to.
But, well, then the Tanana Fishermen's Association, or whatever they called themselves, and along with brought a lawsuit against ADF&G, which was defeated or not allowed to proceed.
Right.
And, you know, they were trying to make the argument that this was a cultural practice,
and it was clearly not.
Well, to me, anyway.
Well, in both, no, it wasn't. They knew they were. I mean, gosh, Earhart's were just making money hand over fist. They knew it was no freaking culture thing to do with it.
Self-serving, right?
Well, it's the same thing with what's going on downriver. I mean, it's the same. That's not cultural stuff. That's money-making stuff, and it has nothing to do with culture anymore.
Mm-hmm. It can be a subtle segue from one into the other, and sometimes it could be a gray area. I mean, you could
to
say,
a point, but not to that
hand,
point.
You know, people are fishermen and they're hunters. This is what they do. That's a cultural thing. But then, you know, something like selling eggs or selling subsistence caught fish, you know, and it's part of the problem too.
But people wouldn't do it if it wasn't, if it was just cultural, and they wouldn't do all that work for nothing. You know, not going to do it.
There's an economic component of what's your culture. I mean, you know, going out and hunting is economics. You know, that's.
I realize that, but to the point, I mean, like Aaron pointed out, a bunch of those people, more people than not that fish down there don't even live down there anymore because they make enough money they can live elsewhere. It was the same with when I lived in Chignik Lake, you know. Half the town had lived in Seattle or Anchorage because they didn't have to live there anymore. They made enough money that they could move out, and they, you know, had enough sense to how to save their money and whatever.
I wonder now if the guys who have to travel to get to the fishing grounds have been eliminated, if there's more local guys now.
I would think so. Well, the people that used to go down there to fish from up here don't do it anymore.
Yeah.
I would think, yes, it would have a big effect on it.
But, yeah, people who went down there originally to go travel, yeah, they weren't doing it for the culture.
No, they were doing it to make money. You know, I mean, everybody has to make a living, but anyway, I think it's getting lost.
Talk a little about from my distance, it seems like you guys work really hard and, you know, there isn't all that much money in it. And it must cost you a fair bit just to gear up boat motor, and grub up and set up that camp. And I'd like for people to get a sense of, you know, are you wealthy as a result
no.
of this?
No. But but it's a beautiful life. I mean,
okay, but yeah. Say the whole picture, you know, because mm-hmm. I don't know if people are thinking, well, you're probably making $50,000 a year.
No,
or something
we're
like
not
this.
Even making, on this, we're not even making 20.
But if you care to say.
Without the commercial, with just. Boy, I don't know if we should say.
I think I'm afraid that it's going to give fuel to people who would like to shut down subsistence.
Okay.
Shut down customary trade.
But no, it's not. I mean, it's less, put it this way, it's less than 15,000.
Okay.
And we're pretty damn efficient.
And but like, what are some of your costs?
Gas, mostly.
Give me an idea.
I don't know. Let's see. Well, I could figure it out.
What do you pay a gallon for both gas?
$5.60 a gallon.
$5.60.
It's about, how do we figure, $70 a trip, $75 a trip.
Call it 75.
One way?
No, round trip.
Round trip. Okay. And during the course of the summer, we're probably averaging probably a little, not quite a trip a week, but.
No, but then come fall time, you got to make a bunch of trips. I don't know if you should include that or not. Well, I guess you could.
Well, I'm thinking averaged out.
Okay, the 15,000 plus you have to include dog food.
The value.
The value of dog food. You could put it up to 20,000. That would be fair. We probably spend what on gas? 2,000? That's a guess. You know.
Groceries you're going to eat anyway.
We don't have, it's not like, you know, actually you spend less money when you're up there. There's no place to spend your money, so you're not going to go to the store and, you know, get stuff you wouldn't, you know, need anyway. So,
the unfactored thing is a million unpaid hours of hard work.
Oh, that's, you don't do it by the, yeah, you don't do it by the hour.
Yeah.
I mean, you're getting this, you get to be outside, you know, which I really like. You're in a beautiful place. You're on the water all summer, literally right on the water. I mean.
Give me some idea of your work schedule or hours.
12 hours a day during cane season?
No, make that more like
14 sometimes.
14 hours a day. I mean, get up at 9 in the morning, go up and. If the fish wheel's been running, empty out the fish wheel, adjust it if the water came in or out. If not, if it's shut down and you already have fish in a box of cold water, you know, this creek with a hose running into a tank, and you keep your fish there, the dead fish, keeps them nice and cold and ready to go. Then, you know, you spend the morning filleting them. Then you pack them up by hand.
In a big tote.
In a tote with a litter. Up the top of the bank by the smokehouse, where there's a little sort of a cutting platform shack thing. Then you stand there for till
hours.
Probably, you know, maybe eight, nine, ten at night, cutting those fish up.
You gotta feed dogs.
Then feed dogs.
Make
then you
a
have
dog
to stoke
pot.
The smokehouse. Then you have to make a dog pot with. The bycatch, in this case is summer chum and whitefish, or king heads and guts, collapse into bed about maybe 12:30, 1 o'clock, a couple hours.
We don't do that 7 days a week. So.
No, but that goes kind of through the height of king season.
And plus, now that we have no kids at our camp anymore, like I was saying before about the family thing, now we have. I mean, the kids used to. Do a lot of work, you know. I mean, they were a lot of work themselves, but, you know, they would feed dogs, make the dog pot, you know, help with the wheel, you know, haul fish. I mean, they did a lot of stuff, you know. When they got older, they made supper, and so now it's just Charlie and me again, and we're getting older. We're definitely going to have to cut back, you know. We're not going to be able to maintain that day after day after day, mm-hmm. and, you know. Have any body parts left that are working. So.
Side two, take two.
So, I mean, that's why people aren't doing it anymore as well. I mean, when you had commercial in there, you know, with everything together, like Carly said before, it made it worth it. I'm not ready to give up on it. I like being up there in the summertime. It's way nicer than being here in Tanana. There's no bugs. It's just, I mean, you couldn't ask for a nicer place to work. But you don't look at it as hourly wage. It's just, there's no way, you know, you'd be making a couple bucks an hour, you know.
Any idea, given that you don't work every day like you described, but lots of days or 14 hours, what would you guess is your average weekly hours worked?
Per person? Let's see, 15, 28. I don't know, 80?
80 hours, probably.
80 hours for each of us?
I mean, some of those hours are pleasant hours. They're not all, like, grueling hard
work. No, I mean, I enjoy standing up there.
It's lovely to get in the boat on a hot summer's day and take a run up to the fish wheel and, you know, pick up the fish and take them and put them in the cold water. I mean, this is nice work. But
oh, I like standing up there, you know, and watching the, you know, while you're cutting. And
yeah.
I mean, it's just, you know, you're doing it for so many hours, it's really hard work.
So roughly how many weeks?
Well, King run lasts for about 5 weeks. That's the slow beginning and the slow ending.
Mid-June to the end of July.
And, you know, you're also doing a bunch of jarring of fish or canning, which you usually do later in the, you know, like your rainy days. You can't cut fish in the rain. They don't make it. So you'll jar fish during then, or you just won't cut because there's no point. So if you get a rainy year, even if the fish are coming in good, you can't cut fish. If you have bad weather, they don't dry. They'll go sour and you have to throw them away.
Okay, so 5 weeks on the Kings. How about the two chum runs?
The summer chum run. We do not use a summer chum run. They're no good.
Except for dog food.
Well, if we catch them, we caught them for dog food, but they're not even good dog food. There's no oil left in them by the time they get up here. They're very dry. You know, they dry up to cardboard, basically.
Not good for cut dog food. They're fine for just throwing in the pot and cooking up as a daily thing. That's their
diet. As long as you throw in a little bit of Kings.
So you're doing that, though?
Yes.
Yeah.
How many weeks?
For the summer chum, I don't know. It hardly matters. We only cut a couple hundred of them. A couple weeks, 3 weeks maybe, that's going on. But, you know, we dry. Hopefully most of the King, by the time the summer chum show up, hopefully most of the King run is done. I mean, we've had years when we've had to sit at the wheel and had the kids take turns sitting at the wheel throwing back summer chums because there were so many of them just to get Kings to cut.
What's their span of run by the rapids?
Summer chum?
Where do they go to spawn?
Yeah, what's the period?
Oh, that's from, probably like about
the second week in July?
Week of July till the 1st of August. Then it switches over to fall chum.
And it's just a gradual thing. It's like, you know.
They bleed into each other, but it's usually apparent when the fall chum first arrived because there's a cohort of really nice silvery fish that cut for people food. Then as August proceeds, by the time you get to the end of August, the quality is getting to be a lot less. There's not that many silver ones. They're striped, marked up, more white flesh, and those we begin to cut for dog food, cut and dry to begin with.
I mean, it varies too. I mean, we've had they call them silvers here, the first chums that show up, because they're not silver salmon.
That always threw me.
Yes, yeah. They call them silvers here, but just because they're silvery, they're chum salmon. They can show up as early as late July, as late as the middle of August. It barely varies. I mean, like sometimes you'll get a couple of weeks where you're not cutting any fish at all. You're just waiting for the fish to show up.
Go pick berries or do projects or whatever.
Get caught up on your projects, you know, whatever you're doing.
Okay, but.
And then they run till the middle of, the chums run till the middle of, well,
September.
Well, for us up at Rapids, they run later here that are going up to Tanana, but. But the last 3 weeks of that, I mean, they're not good for people food at all.
So fall chum is around 1st of August?
Around 1st of August, anywhere
till
middle to late September.
But the silvers component of that. In other words, the nice, pretty ones, they only go for maybe 2 weeks or something, and then they start to tail off.
But give me an idea of the week spent on fall chums.
Totally.
A month.
Month plus, 6 weeks.
Depends.
Okay.
It depends how you go. But I mean, the last chums are put.
We're not cutting.
Are put into a crib too, as the, you know, like this year I think it was around the 10th of September, that's when we did crib fishing, which is like the last blast of dog food.
Maybe go ahead and tell people what crib fishing
is. Well, what you do is when the weather's starting to get cool and in kind of after that first week of September, at least you hope it's getting cool. Global warming seems to be changing, but you take the fish and you put them whole into a sort of a loose construction, sort of a box, you could put stakes in the ground and kind of make a fence of tin, and you just pile the fish in there and let them sour, they ferment. It's not like you'd think, they don't get rotten, but they get a very strong, smelly, cheesy component.
So that the dogs can eat them whole without being, they can eat them when they're frozen. And because if a dog eats a raw fish, it'll throw it up. It can't digest it.
Fresh green fish. They'll just keep throwing it up and they'll keep eating it until they can finally digest it. But
if you ferment them or dry them or cook them, then they can eat them. And so one way to preserve fish in a big quantity, and we do about 2,000 crib fish, is we put them all in this pile, I let them ferment, and then when it gets really cold out, like 10 below or so, we throw them all out, let them freeze solid, and stack them like wood. And then the dogs just eat them frozen like that.
They don't degrade enough in the pit
to where you can
still pull them out individually.
You can pull them out whole.
They're plenty smelly, but they smell like Limburger.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
I remember once.
But the dogs love them.
I remember one time running a bucket of crib fish in a pot. You know, I guess I got bummed some off of you or something to feed my team, and I was running them back out toward the maybe McCann's place out there, the old roadhouse, in the sled, and I had in a bucket. I wasn't going very far, you know, but I thought I could.
It was cooked?
It was liquid.
Oh.
That was a big mistake.
That was a big mistake.
Shouldn't cook them.
I hit a bump on that thing. Oh. A tsunami, and it came right up in my face.
Oh my God.
Oh. It's
disgusting.
That stayed a long time.
Oh, yeah. Well, I wasn't given any number.
No, I know.
But anyways, you know, like this other guy, he'll fish a lot later because he's got a wheel where the fish are going up the Tanana, and they go later in the year. And so his fish are greener, they're fresher, and he'll cook his. But like our fish are more sour, they won't even eat it if you cook it. They just won't touch it.
Really?
No. They'll eat it, the crib fish. You chop, you know, like we'll give a half a fish to a dog a day, and we'll chop an old fish in half and throw it, and they just eat it frozen, and they love it.
Some people used to eat crib fish like that too. They would more often with white fish, but there's a guy in town who's done it.
You
sour them, and then you slice them very, very thin and eat them kind of frozen, the crispy little flakes.
It's like Limburger cheese, you know?
Yeah, it's like a cheesy cheese.
Oh,
so
you.
They say. I never had the guts. hey, one thing I wanted to say too about the cultural component of the king salmon that we catch whether they be frozen or if we've cut strips or something like that, there's a lot of them that are just given away free gratis to people in the village. And the reason that is because, you know, where we live here in Tanana, you know, a big value among Athabascan people is sharing. As a matter of fact, probably one of the cardinal sins, which a lot of white people don't realize when they come here, would be to be cheap. If you have the ability and the wherewithal to give somebody a ride, you are honor bound to give them that ride. If you have a good fish wheel spot and have been fortunate enough to catch all these fish, you are really kind of expected to share them. So, and with
less people fishing in Tanana, that's probably gotten to be more rather than less, and I think that's one reason why we, you know, enjoy the support of local people to do this, is because they get to enjoy some of the fruits of the labor, of our labors. Some of it we sell as well, but a lot of it gets given away for potlatches or just to some nice old lady who, you know,
or just anybody. I mean,
just anybody
when
who
you
wants
first,
the fish.
You know, when you first catch fish, that's what we do with them. We bring them down here and we just give them away.
Pass them out.
Pass them out.
I can remember being up at your fish camp and people motoring up, and, you know, just basically wanting a fish.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or more.
Yeah. So, but that's a real big cultural thing around here. You just,
So, but to finish off my extremely rough count, you know, it's, I'm not trying to get hard numbers or anything. I know this is just rough, but you're roughly doing 80 hours a week a lot of the time, and you're roughly doing about 14 weeks of work.
Not at 80 hours a week.
No, okay.
No,
okay.
Because not all those 14 weeks are we working 80 hours a week.
Okay, does the 14 look like a fair number?
14 weeks of work? Yeah.
Well, yeah, because you got to get there at the beginning of June to get things set up.
June, July, August. We're basically working 4 months to do this fish camp thing. That's what it would come out to be, more like 4 months. But they're not all, you know, like in the beginning, you got to do any repair on your fish wheel. You have to, any repair on your boat, you know, just get ready to go up.
Yeah, those would be maybe 8-10-hour days or something like
that.
12-hour days.
Not that. We don't work 12-hour days anymore.
Probably 8 to 10 early on. And then in the slack, in the so-called slack time, there might be like, you know, 6 to 8-hour days, like in between seasons or something.
Yeah, and then we... But, you know, when the height of king season and the height of chum season, we're definitely putting in those 14-hour days.
Yep.
But not 14 weeks of it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, I mean, with all that, you know, I can give people an idea what we're talking about, roughly.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, some of the other intangible benefits of it, you know, you're at the same time, you know, you're putting up food for yourself, which is a big part of our diet. You've got a garden, so you're growing stuff to eat. Ruth's famous rapid tomatoes, for example. You're enjoying a beautiful place to be, and you're keeping the dogs alive and thriving, and
I notice how often you guys steer this toward, you know, how beautiful it is and all the benefits that are coming on, and I think that's really neat how you know, a lot of people would look at it as a ton of work, and a lot of people would be performing in the equation of Jesus Christ, look how much work this is, how little money this is, and stuff like that, and I think would be very sympathetic toward your position with respect to the regulation of the fish compared to the lower river guys, who are much more flush. But you guys never seem to say that. You don't seem to talk that way. You seem to say, you know, this is a beautiful life.
Well, I'm
we're not in it for the money.
Yeah. I mean, this is like a dream come true for me. I always wanted to be a hunter-gatherer, and I got my wish. And I also really I really feel lucky to have lived in a culture that's a hunter-gatherer culture, and it really enjoys a kind of freedom that I think almost nobody does in the Western world now. I mean, it's kind of a throwback in a lot of ways, sort of tribal existence. Maybe they live that way in Afghanistan, I don't know, but there's a sense of the way people walk on the ground here that is sort of that connection to land, the land, which is really something different. You know, it's not sort of looking around going, are we allowed to do this? This is their home ground, they've been here forever. of course they can do it, as long as it doesn't, you know, step on their neighbor's feet or you know, isn't socially unacceptable. They can. They have that ability to. And it's one of the last places in the world where you still can do that. So I feel very lucky on that account. I feel
very lucky, too, that, you know, we were accepted, you know, not being from here, you know. I mean, family's a really big deal around here. But, you know, we've, you know, a lot of kids
support.
Will call us auntie or, you know, or, you know, people have just accepted us as part of the group, you know.
More than accepted, supported and encouraged us, too, in what we're doing up
right.
there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean,
it's almost like we're vicariously... doing what they would like to do if they had the time, but no, they got this job up on the...
Well, you also hear people say, well, I did that growing up. I'm not going back to that anymore. Of course, they did it the hard way back then, you know. I mean, you'll hear people our age or a little older, like, oh, yeah, I remember that. But, you know, that was before they had motors.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like when Freddie talked about, oh, me and Teddy, we saved up all of our money and get a 6-horse motor, and I swore I would never walk again, you know, and he didn't.
Because they had to walk miles up to the fish
up camp. To the camp every
from
day.
From their camp up to the rapids with, you know, pulling a canoe.
When you say from their camp?
Down, let's see, it's probably like 4 miles downriver.
And they'd have to do it twice a day.
Yeah.
I knew every rock on that beach.
Pretty,
you
know?
Like,
how did they get to their camp to start with?
Like a long boat, you know, pulled along by dogs.
But from Tanana. They lived up, Rampart, they lived up there year round.
Yeah, they kind of moved around, I guess.
Yeah, but they didn't live in Tanana until the kids were older.
But is there enough consistent bars between here and the rapids that you could do it with a dog team all the way up?
People did it on this shore. They would go up on this shore.
Really?
They'd go all the way. They'd go along. Well, that's how they got up there.
Yeah.
And you walked. Everybody, most people walked. Most of the people walked, and the dogs pulled the gear in the boat.
Is the water low enough that there's some kind of beach all the way?
Well, it
most
might be like a
time.
Rocky, steep beach, but...
Oh, yeah, it wasn't.
And I suppose they would... I don't know. I think they would switch back and forth, too. They'd go over to, you know, to cut the corner.
I don't know that they
whatever.
Did that.
Lose a half a mile.
Yeah.
Because...
On the other hand, how they're going to get past those bluffs... I think they had to sometimes.
Yeah, unless they portaged the canoe around.
Of course, the dogs could do a lot better on the steep stuff than a person.
Yeah,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If they can all fit in the boat. But, geez, that's really...
Oh, yeah, it was rough. That's why they didn't go back and forth. They were up there for the duration, or maybe one trip.
Well, their outfits were a lot simpler then, too.
Yeah, they didn't have anything.
You know, a wall tent and some pots and pans and some fish-cutting knives, and not like these days, you know. At least when we had kids.
Yeah, everything.
You know, the knee boards and the water skis and...
Yeah, that's
and all the gas. And,
right.
And all my nieces and nephews, they got that great experience to be raised there, you know, growing up with a fish camp, and they'll never regret that, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. But when Si and Ezra left this summer, though, I mean, they were staying at Stanley's and working when they left this summer, so I said, well... I maybe be back in a couple of years, maybe. They're like, I'm getting the hell out of it. But no, I know when they get older that they will really appreciate it. I mean, Colin and Rhea are already talking like that,
yeah.
You know.
Well, those guys still come back, you know, for...
Well, yeah, for the weekend.
Yeah, but, you know,
they're not doing much work either.
Come back for a little while.
They're on vacation.
Hey, we're going to...
I know.
You got a few more hard balls for us, but...
I think we're good here.
Get going. We're going to eat.
Leftover jamboree?
Yeah, I got that rice and soup.
Good.
Take
a nice salad.
We got feed fish.
Yeah.
And we got a couple of beers, too.
That's right.
Well, on that note, we'll say goodbye to our listening audience.
Goodbye.